My name is Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform. I want to welcome you on behalf of Senator Rockefeller and Senator Collins and our board of directors to this briefing on one of the most widely touted ways of bringing greater value to our health care spending and better health to the American public, that is to say, the patient-centered medical home. It's a sort of jargony way of describing an arrangement where a person can have full-time access to a primary care physician and care team and coordination of all needed care with an emphasis on managing chronic conditions. We're pleased to have co-sponsoring today's program, the Commonwealth Fund, which is soon to enter its second century of philanthropy, supporting work now on a range of health policy issues with an emphasis on vulnerable populations. Commonwealth's also done and funded, I should say, a lot of seminal work specifically on medical homes. And we're doubly pleased to have with us the fund's Belinda Abrams to introduce that topic and help moderate. And you'll hear from her in a second. The PCMH, how's that for jargon, has been around in one form or another for a long time, really, but only now is it starting to get a lot of attention. There are Medicare demonstrations. There is a certification by the National Committee for Quality Assurance. There's even favorable mention of it in some of the presidential campaign documents. Today we're going to take a closer look at it, at its potential to improve delivery and value of health care, and its future in both government and private coverage arrangements. Our learning, by the way, is going to be substantially enhanced by the current issue of Health Affairs, which features several articles about medical homes. Our thanks to the new editor of Health Affairs, Susan Denser, for making copies of the journal available to those of you attending this program today. If you don't already subscribe, by the way, you really should. There isn't any better policy journal around. Before I introduce my co-moderator in today's panel, just a couple of logistical notes. You know you're going to be able to see a webcast of this briefing by Monday. No, that would not be right. By Tuesday morning on kaisernetwork.org, followed a couple of days later by a transcript and electronic copies of all the materials in your kits. We'll send you an email to know, so you'll know when all of that is available. We have microphones that you can use to ask questions once we've heard the presentations. There are green question cards you can write on and hand them up so that we can ask them up here. And, of course, we'd really like it if you would fill out the blue evaluation form before you leave so that we can improve these sessions for you as we go along. So this is the last Alliance briefing of the summer by about, 3 hours? And I can't think of any better way of doing that last event as a wonderful sum up than by examining medical homes. And I can't think of anybody I'd rather have co-moderating than the fund's Melissa Abrams. I'm not going to take the time. I've already apologized to everybody for not giving them the introductions they deserve, and that includes Melinda, who actually directs the fund's patient-centered primary care program. She's done a ton of work on improving preventive and developmental services, especially for low-income children, and we're pleased to have her with us today. Melinda?
Thanks, Ed. There has been a lot of discussion about the patient-centered medical home, and I really want to thank everyone for showing up to today's briefing. In many ways, the concept of a patient-centered medical home is an effort to try to strengthen primary care. And part of the reason we care so much about primary care, other than the fact that it has been underinvested in the United States, is that we know from decades of research that countries with strong foundations of primary care are more likely to have better quality, lower costs, and greater equity. What you see on this chart is results from a study by Barbara Starfield, preeminent scholar on primary care at Johns Hopkins University, that essentially shows countries with strong orientation to primary care and those with strong primary care scores, like the United Kingdom, scored the best and seem to, on average, spend less per capita on healthcare expenditures. What you'll notice is the black diamond towards the bottom and all the way to the right is where the United States is, showing that we have not only do we spend more per capita, but also graphically displays and portrays how we have a weak system of primary care. The principle driving the principle driving patient-centered medical home and patient-centered care is really relatively simple. It is that the health system should be designed and organized around the patient and not around financing and physicians and administrators. And one approach to providing patient-centered primary care is the patient-centered medical home, which organizes care around the relationship between the clinician and the patient. In February of 2007, more than 300,000 internists, pediatricians, family physicians, and osteopaths came together and released the joint principles for the patient-centered medical home, the characteristics of which are listed here and include having a personal physician and a whole person orientation and better care coordination. But I still find many times when I talk about this that there's lots of question of, well, what does this mean in practical terms? So I'm going to try to explain that, which is that in a medical home, a patient can expect to obtain care from the physician practice on holidays, evenings, and weekends without going to the emergency room. The patient could have medical questions answered either by telephone or email the same day that she contacts the office. In a medical home, non-urgent care appointments could be scheduled 1 or 2 days ahead of time instead of weeks or months. And in a medical home, the primary care clinician helps the patient select a specialist, that the patients are partners in their care. The clinical care team reviews treatment options, goes over conflicting advice from multiple providers that patients inevitably receive, helps explain that different advice, and regularly solicits feedback from patients about their experience, and also uses that information to improve the quality of care that's provided in that practice. To work well, a patient-centered medical home requires improved infrastructure, such as electronic health records or patient registries, or the ability to review test results remotely. But most importantly, and this is in many ways what distinguishes the discussion around the patient-centered medical home in 2008 from previous discussions, whether it be about managed care or the chronic care model, most importantly, the patient-centered medical home also requires payment reform. So what I was, but I also want to make one other point which falls into that, which is that for the medical home concept to flourish, it needs a greater organization in our healthcare system. And that both doctors Diane Rittenhouse and Duane Davis will present the value and importance of organization when they speak. The Commonwealth Fund Commission on a High Performance Health System recognizes how the current fragmentation of our delivery system fundamentally contributes to our poor performance, and therefore outlines 6 attributes of what an ideal high-performing delivery care system would include, such as having clinical information available at the appropriate time, coordination of care, making providers accountable, helping them work in teams, making sure that patients have easy access to appropriate care, again, more about accountability, and that the system is continuously innovating. And once again, I will say, and that's what presented in this graphic here, both of these last 2 slides are included in a report from our commission that came out in August called Organizing for a High-Performance Health System, which shows that how with different kinds of payments and with better there is a relationship between more organization and different kinds of payment, moving away from fee-for-service and more towards bundled payments. And so, again, I think that Dr. Berenson will talk a little bit about the payment and some of the problems that the medical home is trying to solve. And we will also hear a lot about organization from our other speakers. So thank you very much.
We have some rambunctious microphones. Sometimes they turn on and sometimes they don't. And with luck, every time I try to use them for your standpoint, they won't turn on. But they will work for Bob Berenson. We're going to start with Bob. He's a senior fellow at the Urban Institute. He's a primary care physician. He ran a small PPO in the D.C. area. He held a series of high-level posts in what is now CMS involving Medicare payment and with the White House domestic policy staff. And he is the lead author of the lead article in the Special Health Affairs section on PCMHs. So, Bob, thanks very much for being with us. We look forward to hearing what you say.
And I want to thank the American College of Physicians and the Commonwealth Fund for funding our group that, amongst other things, did produce that health affairs article. I will dispense with my normal hilarious monologue because I have 20 minutes worth of material to do in 10 minutes, and your thing isn't going there, so I'm still at 10 minutes. All right.
Whoops, got it going down.
Keep going that direction. That would be fine. So I'm going to go through a whole bunch of slides fairly quickly. It'll be in your handouts. You can go back, but I wanted to make a bunch of points here. First of all, there's a lot of interest in this patient-centered medical home. I'm actually concerned, as are others, that it's beginning to attain the status of silver bullet solution to problems in healthcare, and we've seen some other silver bullet solutions that sort of were overhyped and then people were disappointed. We should be careful about that, but this is part of presidential campaigns. We've got purchasers of all kinds supportive. The primary care groups, even some of the specialty groups, are all supportive of the medical home. And what problem are we trying to solve? Well, a few have been identified as problems that the medical home might be able to solve. There are recognized deficiencies in patient-centered aspects of care, the ones that Melinda was talking about earlier. We don't do very well on international comparisons on these elements. The growing challenge of chronic care, and I'll come back to that, and some people actually almost equate the medical home with better chronic care management. And then three is the relatively poor primary care compensation that exists, and that builds on the kinds of findings that Melinda had presented about health systems that have more primary care have, in international comparisons pulled together by Barbara Starfield, do better on quality and at lower cost, and yet we are having increasing shortages of primary care, so maybe the medical home is a way to get that flow going. So let me briefly go through very quickly support for those problems I identified. One of the best articles I've ever read in health policy by Ed Wagner and his group associated with Group Health of Puget Sound, amidst the press of acutely ill patients, it is difficult for even the most motivated and elegantly trained providers to assure that patients receive the systematic assessments, preventive interventions, education, psychosocial support, and follow-up that they need. He described that as the tyranny of the urgent. This was from a British Medical Journal article that's gotten some attention. Across the globe, doctors are miserable because they feel like hamsters on a treadmill. They must run faster just to stand still. The result of the wheel going faster is not only a reduction in the quality of care, but also a reduction in professional satisfaction and an increase in burnout amongst physicians. So the hamster on a treadmill problem. How are patients affected by this? Asking patients to repeat back what the physician told them, half of them get it wrong. Patients making an initial statement of their problem were interrupted by their primary physician after an average of 23 seconds. In 23% of those visits, the physician did not ask the patient for his or her concerns at all. That's the hamster on the treadmill. The doctor's pushing people through. On the spending issue, it's a whole bunch of studies are coming out that support this general finding that without going through all the details, if you have no chronic care conditions, which is about 22% of the Medicare population, you spend less than 1% of Medicare. If you've got five or more, that's about 20%, you're responsible for two-thirds of Medicare spending. And more recent data found that 75% of high-cost beneficiaries had one of seven chronic conditions, and 70% of inpatient spending was for beneficiaries with one of these. And so the theory is that if we do a better job in our ambulatory management of these conditions, maybe we could reduce inpatient spending. Data on... So let's make this more concrete. If you've got chronic conditions, zero chronic conditions, you get 3.7 prescriptions a year. If you've got five or more, you get 49 prescriptions a year. This sort of invites the question of, well, can something go wrong with 49 prescriptions in terms of incompatibility, redundancy, confusion by the patient as to what he or she should be taking? And similarly, in relationship to chronic conditions, if you have no chronic conditions, you see 1.3 physicians a year. If you have five or more, 14 different physicians are submitting claims to Medicare on your behalf. This is, again, a Medicare population. Now, some of those are one-time events, an anesthesiologist or radiologist, but many of those physicians are providing concurrent ongoing care, and that suggests that maybe there are some problems, and we actually have some data on this. Incidents in the past 12 months, I won't go through all of them, but 50, it's interesting how things often cluster around. This is like Beth McGlynn's 55% of people get what they're supposed to get. 54% of people have been told about a possibly harmful drug interaction, 54% sent for duplicate tests, et cetera. On the primary care issue, in 98, just as the sort of the height of managed care, when it looked like there was going to be a health system reform built around primary care, 54% of internal medicine residents chose general medicine. By 2005, it was down to 20%. And the similar phenomenon is happening in family medicine. Residency slots are being filled with foreign-born graduates of foreign medical schools, and so we're robbing other countries of their important workforce and not producing our own graduates to go into this important area. And payment is part of the reason and why we think that needs to be addressed. Just I pulled a couple of specialties. Primary care between 95 and 2004 got a 21% 10-year increase. Dermatology got a 75% increase. It's not coincidental that medical school graduates are told to follow the road to success, where road stands for radiology, orthopedics, anesthesiology, and dermatology. Our payment systems are encouraging the entering into niche specialties. We don't only lack general primary care docs, but nobody wants to go into general surgery either. The generalists are the ones who are not doing well under current payment systems. The medical home concept is actually was brought together. There have been four sort of streams. Pediatrics have had medical homes going back 30 to 40 years. There's been a lot of work on primary care. World Health Organization convened in the 70s a sort of international conference, and that generated primary care residencies in the U.S. Primary care case management was what it was called by some managed care companies, and it got the pejorative term of gatekeepers. Actually, in Medicaid, primary care case management was a positive thing, providing a source of care for people who hadn't had good access to care. And in more recent years, practice redesign with electronic medical records and the Wagner chronic care model came along. This was all put together in what I think is sort of the best sort of call it a synthesis of these various streams by Karen Davis, Steve Schoenbaum, and Marie O'Day, two of whom are here today. Sort of a potential pulling all of this together, but still ambitious for a practice. So what are the challenges in my last 2 minutes? There is, in fact, a lack of agreement on operational definitions. Some people emphasize it's about chronic care management. Some think it's you got to get traditional primary care and patient-centeredness right, and that means it should be available for all patients. Even if we paid practices more, what's going to deal with the tyranny of the urgent? With a shortage of primary care physicians, there are still patients coming in with all of the acute problems that they've always come in with. Will that practice be able to provide yet additional services? Practice size and scope are implicit here. I think we should really be distinguishing large organizations, like you're going to hear about Geisinger and what they're capable of doing, from a solo or small single specialty practice, and whether they can provide that, whether that latter practice can provide all the elements of the medical home or should be part of virtual organizations in a community. To whom should it apply? Again, all patients are limited to chronic care patients. I can make arguments on either side, and we can come back to that. As Diane is going to be talking about, there are significant management challenges, even in large groups with an interest. Many elements are not adopted of the medical home. We have an issue of whether this is really just for primary care physicians or what's called principal care physicians. That might be an endocrinologist taking care of a patient with diabetes or an oncologist taking care of a patient with newly diagnosed cancer. Do we expect the patients in any way to have a commitment to going through their primary care or their patient-centered medical home before they go to see a specialist or not is an issue. And what I'm going to finish with is this idea that everybody now seems to be hanging on the medical home, everything that they want to improve the health system. And so that can be all sorts of good things, better attention to diagnosing and treating alcoholism or depression or doing shared decision-making, being more attentive to health disparities. I mean, pretty soon you start hanging everything on this model, and it dies of its own weight. So let me finish with two final ones. Even though there's broad interest, and I showed you in the first slide that the payers are part of a coalition to try to promote this, there is some skepticism amongst the payers because they've been sold on other approaches that haven't really worked out. Vendor-based disease management, while it may have some marginal benefits in some situations, hasn't been sort of the panacea that some had hoped for it. There is concern that the patient-centered medical home is a stalking horse for more money for services that practices should already be providing. That is a, you know, we're going to put more money into this and get what we already think we're paying for. And then there are the consumer issues. Is this gatekeeper and drag? Let me finish with this slide. And this was interesting from an article 5 years ago before the current both the language about patient-centered medical homes as well as all the current work. Primary care could also expand beyond its more restrictive role as provider of medical care. The danger, of course, is that primary care's new role will be even more expansive and varied than today's already diverse activities. A redefinition of primary care must be cognizant of this risk, focus on optimizing primary care's strengths, and avoid assuming too many peripheral responsibilities in its formulation. So with that, let me finish, and I'll be happy to discuss this more later. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you, Bob. You laid out a whole range of things to think about as we consider this topic. Next, we're going to hear from Diane Rittenhouse. She's on the faculty at the University of California, San Francisco, and at the Philip Lee Health Policy Institute. I love that. She, too, is a physician and a researcher. She concentrates on the organizing, financing, and delivery of primary care, particularly for underserved populations, and is the primary author of one of the signal papers in the health affairs that you have in front of you. Diane, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to thank the Alliance for Health Reform and the Commonwealth Fund for bringing us all together around this very important topic of primary care innovation. It's certainly near and dear to my heart as both a professor of family medicine and health policy and also as a practicing family physician. I'm going to present today some research that we've done around this issue and provide some numbers and a sense of what's going on across the nation with regard to implementing the patient-centered medical home. So you've heard from our prior speakers a couple of things. One, that there's a large body of knowledge that tells us that primary care is actually an emphasis on primary care is able to increase quality, increase efficiency in the healthcare system, and potentially decrease cost. We've also heard about the patient-centered medical home model as it's currently formulated as a comprehensive health model of healthcare delivery and payment reform that emphasizes primary care. So this is the home, this is the vision, this is no panacea, there's no perfect answer, this isn't necessarily going to be easy, but there is a vision out there, and there are people from many sectors, the providers are behind this, the the plans are demonstrating and piloting this. The payers are certainly very strongly interested in this. So we have a vision, and I was interested in using some data that we had to learn a little bit about it. So these are the joint principles that were agreed upon for the patient-centered medical home, and we saw this in Melinda Abrams' presentation. They're also in your packet. There are seven different domains that are important to the patient-centered medical home. We had data, national data, on four of them. So I just wanted to point out as we go forward that we're going to be looking at the domains here that are highlighted in yellow: the physician-directed medical practice, the coordination and integration of care, the emphasis on quality and safety, and enhanced access. And the question that we asked was, to what extent is the medical practice infrastructure in place to support the implementation of the patient-centered medical home in the U.S.? The data that we had were from the National Study of Physician Organizations and the Care of Chronic Illness, and these are my co-investigators at both the University of California, Berkeley, and the University of Chicago. And this work was funded by the Commonwealth Fund along with RWJ Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation. I won't go into detail on the methods other than to say that there is no clean list of all the physician practices in the country. We don't have a central repository where we keep track of physician organizations and physician practices. We set out to look at all of the practices in the United States that have 20 or more doctors. So these were the larger medical groups we were interested in. And we started with a very large list. We called them all. We found that many of them didn't exist. Some of them had merged. Some of them had gone out of business. Some of them weren't actually medical groups. We identified all medical groups in the country that had 20 or more physicians. And for this particular analysis, I'm limiting this to the medical groups who said, yes, we care for patients with diabetes, we care for patients with asthma, we care for patients with congestive heart failure, we care for patients with depression, we do preventive care. So we're really looking at those organizations that are heavily primary care focused and have responsibility for caring for the entire patient. So back to the four domains that we were able to look at with this data. This is the first, and it really is about team care. And we define that by saying that the organization has personal physicians that lead a team of individuals at the practice level who collectively take responsibility for the ongoing care of patients. The second domain that we looked at was care integration and coordination. And the kinds of things we asked about here were electronic patient registries for patients with diabetes. So do they have a way of identifying all of their patients who have diabetes to bring them in for routine care? Do they have a way of recognizing all their patients who smoke, who use tobacco? Do they have electronic medical records in place? Do they have clear coordinated communication with other parts of the healthcare system and specialists and hospitals and the emergency departments? And do they use nurse care managers to coordinate care for patients who are particularly ill? In addition to team-based care and coordination integration, we looked at quality and safety. And the kinds of things that we asked about here were, do you provide your physicians with point-of-care decision support so that they have the evidence before them at the moment they're seeing the patient and trying to make a decision that they can quickly access and make evidence-based decisions for treatment? Does the organization routinely feed back data to physicians about their performance and quality? Do they incorporate patient feedback in their own quality improvement activities? And then finally, we looked at access. So we asked, and we were a little bit more limited here. We didn't have information about their hours and some of the things we would have liked to, but we were able to ask about whether or not they used email routinely with their patients and whether or not their patients were able to access their medical records online. So we took these areas of quality and safety, coordination and integration, access, and team care, and we made a list of 20 different components, and that's all in the article, the details of how we did that. But we came up with a scale from 0 to 20, and we assigned each one of these physician organizations a score based on how many of these different components of the patient-centered medical home model they were employing. And this is what we found: wide variation. Nobody scored 20 out of 20. Many groups scored 1 or 2. So that is, they were employing 1 or 2 or 3 of these things out of the 20 that we were asking about. And the average here, both the mean and the median, was 7. So on average across the country, among these large medical groups that have 20 or more physicians who are hypothesized to be in a well-positioned to implement these kinds of things, the average number of components of the patient-centered medical home infrastructure that they're using is 7 out of 20. So you can look at that as glass half empty, glass half full. We can shake our fingers and say, tisk, tisk, these doctors know what they're doing, these organizations suck, and we should really try to figure something else out, and why aren't they working harder? And we can ask them to run harder on the treadmill, and we can ask them to, back to the hamster idea that you saw earlier in Bob Berenson's presentation. Or we can think about the fact that these organizations are existing in a climate where it is very difficult, actually, to implement electronic medical records and to get some of these coordinated activities going, and where reimbursement is not strong for primary care. And yet some other research we're doing that's not yet published looks like we're actually moving the needle on some of this, so that these are actually improvements over time, and these groups are doing better than they were, say, 5 years ago. Certainly, you have to take away from this that there's a long way to go. This is looking at the score by size of practice. So we just broke the practices into groups by quartile. We said, okay, well, if you look at the smallest of the large groups, so they have 20 to 37 doctors, their score tended to be lower. And we saw the score go up with each size quartile. And it was really the groups that have 140 or more physicians, so the largest of the large, that seemed to have the highest scores. We then looked at the groups that were doing very well on all of the components we measured, and we said, let's call these high performers, and we looked at the ones who were doing very poorly relative to their peers on access, quality, integration, and team care. And we broke them out by size as well. And what we found is that the lowest performers were disproportionately represented among the smaller organizations. So, again, these are not small practices. These are not solo practices or small. These are the smallest ones are 20 to 37 physicians. But we didn't see as many low performers among the very, very large groups. And when you look at high performers, they're disproportionately represented among the very, very large groups. We also looked by ownership, and you can see the yellow bar is are the groups that are owned by a hospital or HMO or larger organization, a.k.a. more resources. And the orange bars are those organizations that are owned by physicians solely. And you can see across these three domains that the organizations that were owned by larger entities were employing more of these components. So in summary, we can say that on average, the adoption of the patient-centered medical home infrastructure components are low, that we see wide variation across all of the domains, that the largest of the large groups are doing more, and that those that are owned by larger entities are doing more. And again, this suggests that having more resources available to do things like implement electronic medical records or to set up reminder systems and think about patients on a population level, the more able they are to do that. And this is just to get back to the reminder that we didn't look at the entire patient-centered medical home. So there are very important components of the patient-centered medical home that we did not have data on and that we together need to think about how we're going to look at and analyze and measure going forward. So we looked at the red circle there, which is the infrastructure components. We did not look at whether or not the patients were each assigned a personal physician and whether that personal physician was easily accessible and had an ongoing, continuous relationship with a patient, because certainly a medical home is much more than an electronic medical record here and a reminder there. It's an ongoing relationship with a physician and a group of a team that coordinates care over time. And then we did not look at payment, and certainly this model is not likely to be successful without significant payment reform. So in summary, I'd just like to say that we're working on building this medical home. The system that we have now is broken. We have a vision towards where we want to be. And what I can say, given our data today, is that this is certainly a work in progress.
Thank you so much, Diane. And I note for the record that you finished precisely as your time expired. That's what I call performance-based activity.
How are we going to reward her?
We'll steer the tough questions to you instead of to her. We're going to hear from Dwayne Davis, the Vice President and Chief Medical Officer of the Geisinger Health System. Bob mentioned Geisinger in passing. I'm privileged to have spent some time on the Geisinger campus. For those of you who are unfamiliar with it, you need to get up to speed. It's one of the highest quality health systems in the country. It's based in rural central Pennsylvania. You may have heard about their recent offer of what amounts to a 90-day warranty on heart bypass surgery, and also one of the most ambitious medical home projects anywhere. Dwayne is also a physician. I think Melinda and I are outnumbered on the panel. And he's responsible for all of the health services delivered by Geisinger. Dwayne, thanks for joining us today, and let's hear your story.
Thank you, Ed. Is this working all right? I too want to thank the Alliance and the Commonwealth for inviting us. And as Diane said, this is work in progress. And I'm pleased to be able to come and share some of the progress that we've made so far. What I'd like to do first is just give you a little context. Ed did begin to do that. The first thing that's important is that's a real picture from the back of the campus. It is pretty and a very beautiful place to live, and it is quite rural, although if you've been through central Pennsylvania, you know that it's becoming less rural, although the towns are 10 to 15 miles apart. They're growing together, as they are in many places. To give you a little context, the Geisinger Health System consists of a large group practice, over 700 physicians. Around 200 of those physicians are primary care. I'll talk to you about our struggles with primary care and with recruiting, et cetera, in a minute. We are spread across that geography of 41 counties across north central Pennsylvania, and we have multiple practice sites. We also have several hospitals that are part of the system. And importantly, we have a health insurance arm of the integrated health system, Geisinger Health Plan, that has around 200,000, a little over 200,000 members, including 35,000 Medicare Advantage lives. Some of the data that I'm going to show you is about those lives. One other context point, about one-third of the care that the health system delivers is delivered to Geisinger Health Plan patients. On the other side of the coin, about 30% of the Geisinger Health Plan membership comes to Geisinger for care. So it's really quite a mixed model. A couple of years ago, almost 3 years ago, when we were sitting thinking about how to redesign primary care for a whole bunch of reasons and thinking about our need to create value in central Pennsylvania and in healthcare, we thought that we should charge someone, ourselves, and then some part of our system with perhaps being that value agent, that if we went ahead and did that, that the medical home and chronic care models, at least for us, would initially be an investment. They would cost more. Hopefully, we'll show over time that that's a good investment. But because we had to do that, and because, like any other business, we have a budget, et cetera, we had to look at ways that we could implement this in a way that it would deliver both short-term and long-term value to us. The Proven Health Navigator strategy that we had was this. It's quite a big mouthful of words, and in the discussion we could perhaps discuss that, but I think it's probably more fun to describe it the way we do when we go to a primary care site and we're talking to the care team. And what we say is, think of redesigning this as if you were taking care of your children. They have to have total access to you. You have to know where they are at all times. You have to get them out of trouble when they get into trouble. And you have to help them with problems that they have, or at least help them solve those problems. And when you say that to the care teams, they go, oh, okay, yeah. And I think one of the things that we found is that really trying to simplify this down to how would you do it has been a real learning for us. We define value as these three domains. We're measuring patient experience, we're measuring quality outcomes, and we're measuring efficiency outcomes. I think those measurements are early and probably not the final measurements that everybody would like to have for a program like this, but we needed to start, and so we picked measures, and I'll show you some of the results of those early measures. We started with pilots. We did two pilots in two of our primary care sites in two different towns. One was a blue-collar town, essentially, and one was a university community. We didn't pick them for that reason. We picked them because they had very high numbers of Medicare lives in those practices. We also picked a third pilot that I won't discuss a lot today, but we could potentially talk about in the discussion period, and that was a non-Geisinger primary care site that worked with the Geisinger Health Plan, and we chose a commercial population in that site, primarily because they were champions at trying to and do this. Those two pilots, two different types of pilots, have been very, very educational to us in terms of what we're learning. The other thing we needed to do was to transform our primary care. We have pretty well resourced primary care. They all have electronic medical records. You know, they have a salary. They work in our system. They're highly productive by the current productivity standards of primary care. But as you looked forward, it was without redesigning the way that we delivered care, they would start to lose productivity, and they weren't happy in the way they were delivering care, because they really wanted to deliver care in a way that the two speakers before me have described. And so there were two reasons to do this. One, because we wanted to reinvigorate our primary care. Even though we have over 200 primary cares, we have 20 open spots at any time. And if we can't recruit them, they're hard to recruit. We also know that as a health plan, as a health insurer, primary care is incredibly important to us. And so that was another reason. And then third, we really thought that we could potentially be innovative and redesign the way that we did this. And then the last bullet point's my favorite, because I followed my father-in-law through the healthcare system over the past 2 years. And meaningful coordination truly doesn't exist. And to the degree that we can do that or make progress in doing it, I think we can see some very early wins in this. There are five functional components that we chose because we wanted to try to translate some of the things that you've heard about into a way to try to operationalize this in our primary care. And we knew it needed to be patient-centered, and so each time that we have a discussion or a meeting or a team or a group, we'd say, is that good for the doctors and the staff, or is that good for the patient or the member? And after a while, we all, and I'm a physician too, we all recognized better that we are pretty much doctor-centered and pretty much healthcare delivery-centered, and it really does take a different way to think about it. The second thing that we thought that was missing in primary care, because we had the experience on the health insurance side, was even though many of our sites perhaps would like to manage a population, they have no tools and no skill sets to manage it, and an electronic record in its, you know, non-modified form isn't a very good tool to do that either. And so what we recognized was that there were a lot of things in the health plan that health plans do every day, insurers do every day, that could be leveraged to do this better if we could get the information to that medical home. The care systems we'll talk about in a minute, we did put a quality outcomes program in and a value-based reimbursement program. In the 3 minutes or so we have left, we can't go through all these, but I wanted to get them into the slides so when we said what do those five functional things mean, you would have some of the bullet points that would lead you to understand some of that. So we just heard about 49 drugs, and the RX management program is a really, really important part of doing this well. On the population management side, tools that we use in our insurance arm every day, like predictive modeling, that aren't in primary care sites ordinarily, have become very valuable tools. And integrating our case management that we've had as an insurer, and that was mentioned before, in our disease management into the sites themselves has allowed us to leverage that very significantly. We don't have time to talk about all this, but we do know that it's extremely important to know where these folks are at all times, to work with all of these different kinds of care systems to create ways that you can find out as quickly as possible what's going on, where it's going on, when someone's going to transition from one place to another. Begin to work with specialists, which also mentioned and say, you know, it's a work in progress. We've got a lot of things to do, but we'd like to begin to work also with specialists to have them become a part of what we're trying to accomplish here. And likewise with radiology ancillary services, we've gone to nursing homes and said, here's what we're up to, here's what we're about, would you like to sign on? If you're willing to sign on, here's the way we could do it. The price of admission is just roll up your sleeves and help us try to design this. The quality outcomes, as I said, we've got chronic disease measures, preventive service measures, and satisfaction measures. I'm absolutely convinced they'll morph with time, but we started with a set that I'll show you in a second. And likewise, we changed the way we paid our primary cares. We continue to pay them fee for service. We gave them practice transformation stipends, both the physicians, the staff, and an infrastructure payment. And then we arranged for the results to be shared with them if the results were positive. The initial results are promising. We've had these pilot sites up now almost 2 years. This is one of the pilot sites in terms of its baseline quality metrics and its follow-up quality metrics after a year. And I think you should concentrate on the first four there. The ability to get desired appointments, we haven't actually solved totally, although it isn't too bad at the present time. But above that, the plan of care and the risk assessment essentially were things that didn't exist in our practices either. And by creating those and making sure that they're happening, we're seeing a lot of good things occur. Finally, this is the efficiency result. And the way that we looked at this was all members, these are all, by the way, Medicare members in this data here. All the members in those pilot sites, which is about 3,000 Medicare members to begin with, were counted in our efficiency. And we saw those drops first in inpatient care and in readmission to inpatient. And that came because as we began to coordinate care, we were able to keep folks out of the hospital and folks from going back into the hospital. When you add drugs back in, which is the third line down, you see that the trends aren't as good, but they're still better than our other non-medical home sites, which are also Geisinger sites, which are resourced relatively the same, although the care hasn't been redesigned. And so we're very pleased with these results so far, although we recognize they're early. We've expanded this to 12 more sites, and those sites have been up now about 9 months. And while it's too early to say it's sustainable, the pattern is the same. So what did we learn? We learned that there are tools that we have in our health system that we wouldn't necessarily see as part of this that are very valuable tools, such as predictive modeling, making case managers a key part of the team, but not just the team. It has to be a team, as Diane mentioned, is very, very important. Managing transitions of care from any spot to another spot is a great place to get an early win, both quality-wise and efficiency-wise. Managing nursing home admissions is another great place. We looked at that and actually recognized that almost a third of our Medicare patients were getting readmitted from nursing homes within 30 days. And it had everything to do with lack of coordination, lack of medication reconciliation, even though those physicians, those specialists, those hospitals, and those nursing homes were trying to do as good a job as they could under the current situation. And then finally, leveraging our electronic medical record, which is Epic, in order to build in ways to do many of the things that Diane and Bob mentioned, has also been extremely helpful to us. I do think you can do it without that, but it would be slow and laborious and probably a lot tougher. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks very much, Dwayne. Excuse me. I wonder if I could just follow up before we get going. I want folks to take advantage of the time now that we have for the discussion. As I say, there are microphones that you can ask your question orally from. There are green question cards you can fill out and hold up, and the staff will bring them forward. And let me start off by just asking Dwayne to describe. So many of you have talked about the importance of payment. Could you talk a little bit about the payment that you got for the people involved in the medical home experiment you were describing?
Sure. Thanks. What we did, we decided to approach this by taking our Medicare Advantage lives, the 35,000 lives that we get premium for, and modeling what we thought we could afford to invest in this redesign if it worked and if we were able to get this done. We also know that in our primary care, because they live and work under the same kind of payment system that everybody else did, needed to be realigned. And so we went to them as the insurance arm of our integrated health system and said, would you be interested in doing it this way? We'll continue to pay you fee for service. And in fact, we would expect your visits to go up. But we'll also give you an incentive, because this is hard work. You got to do extra here. You've got to come to meetings. You've got to, you know, act as a team. You got to spend some time on Friday night saving that congestive heart failure patient from getting so bad that they end up in the hospital on the weekend. That's hard work. So we're so convinced this will work, we'll pay you ahead of time. We also gave them an infrastructure payment at the primary care line, because in our system, like everybody else, if they compete with capital for every other thing, they may or may not be at the top of the list. And then finally, we said, if this works and there's savings in it, we will accrue some of those savings to the primary care service line. And that's the model that we've chosen, and so far it has worked well.
And how important is it that you have an insurance company, an insurance plan, as part of this arrangement so that you get the payments in the first place?
I believe that it certainly was easier for us to sit down as an integrated health system and you know, owning both sides and say, okay, how can we make this work? How can it be a win for everybody? It wasn't just super easy, because each of those entities has their own goals and incentives and targets and everything like that. I think it's possible with a non-owned insurer. I think that there is an opportunity for insurers or other folks who have a lot of data and information and infrastructure to be an important partner in this. Not sure that we have the exact way that that should be designed, but it was very important in order to get and start.
Very good. Thank you. In the absence of anybody standing there, we're going to start using some of the cards we got in advance and the ones that are coming up now. Melinda, you want to take a look at that? Person asks what the panelists' views are on which providers should a medical home be built around. Many of the proposals he or she writes for medical homes speak of physicians, but given the shortage of primary care doctors and challenges, particularly in rural underserved areas, does it make sense to expand the list of providers to health professionals such as nurse practitioners? Bob?
I'll give that a try. That was one of my challenges. If, in fact, there's a tyranny of the urgent, we have a shortage of primary care physicians, and now we have a whole bunch of new expectations for what the patient-centered medical home is going to do. We've got a sort of disconnect. As part of the work we're doing for ACP and Commonwealth, we've actually visited a number of practices to get their sense as to what they're doing, and particularly in relationship to the NCQA measurement set that we haven't talked about yet but might come up, and found that there's just a huge variety of responses to the current problem. There, on the one end, you've got something called the ideal medical practice. It used to be called the ideal micro practice, which actually is a practice with one doctor and no staff of any kind and a very elaborate electronic health record. The physician in the practice who we interviewed sees fewer patients a day, has much lower overhead, so in this case he did not have as much staff to support, and feels that he was meeting the expectations of a medical home pretty well. We went to a different practice with one full-time equivalent physician. There was a husband and wife sharing a one full-time equivalent slot, and they had 13 people working in that practice, including a number of nurse practitioners, all working in a, there's no question that they had adopted team-based care and were allocating or figuring out the most efficient way to see patients. And there was no question that in that environment, those nurse practitioners were the continuing care clinician for a number of the patients in the practice. So clearly we will have to develop a number of models. I think one lesson is that we should be looking for performance and not be too prescriptive of how to get there. And unless we do something about the primary care physician workforce, I would call it a crisis, we clearly will have to rely on nurse practitioners, physician assistants, other professionals to be perhaps first line, but certainly to be part of teams if we are serious about this.
Go ahead, Diane.
I just wanted to add one comment. One comment is that one of the goals of the idea here is that you would have people doing what they're best trained to do, and that physicians who have traditionally done a lot of things that they didn't necessarily go to medical school and need to do. So you'd have physicians on teams with other providers, nutritionists, dietitians, physical therapists, nurse practitioners, whatever that team needed to be, social workers, to help. I mean, that's part of the team concept, is that there are those who may be as well-trained or better trained to do certain aspects of what needs to happen in care, and that some of the coaching, some of the counseling, some of the teaching, some of the prescribing and instructing and whatnot can be done by a team of providers and be therefore more accessible to the patient and allow the physician and the other, each provider to really do what they're best trained to do.
That's good. We'd ask you to identify yourself, please.
Susan Hink. I'm a Robert Wood Johnson Health Policy Fellow with the Senate Finance Committee. Medical homes are presented as a new concept. Can you explain how medical homes are different than community health centers?
Good question.
I think you should answer
that. Well, the reason I think you should answer is because in your paper you talk about the four evolutionary streams, and then if I can follow on about the role for low income.
Now, there's actually a bit of a debate, I would say, because there is a long tradition of primary care. It's been defined. It involves access to care, meaning 24/7 access and availability. It means longitudinal continuity, which means a ongoing, continuing relationship with a particular clinician. The original definition suggests comprehensiveness, that this primary care physician should be able to provide a very broad range of services without having to refer. There might have been a fourth, which I'm forgetting on right now. But the point is that some people sort of assume that that's there and then see a special opportunity for the medical home to focus on patients with chronic care management, which does involve a whole new set of activities which have not been part of traditional primary care. I would sort of label them under the category of proactive visit planning, trying to figure out why the patient's coming in, what needs to be done during a visit, so there's decision management support to identify what's missing in their care, registries to bring people back in, teaching self-management skills, relying on others besides a physician, just a whole set of activities which had not been part of the traditional primary care definition. Ideally, and it's in that in the paper I referred to, the medical home would be doing both. The traditional accepted primary care activities, which have been labeled relationship-centered care or patient-centered care, as well as the new activities, which, for better lack of a better term, is the Wagner chronic care model, and that a practice could do both. Whether or not a small practice is able to do more, significantly more than that, to get that primary care piece right is a question, and whether you need in that situation to have a complementary organization so you have, in a sense, virtual teams rather than assuming it's all going to be within one entity. Just specifically on community health centers, I think because of work that I'm aware, I haven't worked with community health centers for many years. I actually used to be in HHS and work with them, but the work that they've been doing in collaboration with Don Berwick at IHI about developing the community health center model, I assume, and I have some knowledge that they are doing the whole care continuum from primary care through adopting the chronic care model. Is there anybody in the audience who has specific expertise on community health centers? Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say two things to follow up. I think community health centers are ideally situated to be patient-centered medical homes. It's not clear to me, and I think that is actually, I think that is the vision. It's not clear to me that that's exactly how they're all functioning and performing at the moment. And in part, it's most likely to do with the large numbers of uninsured for which they have to cross-subsidize and probably the low payments on the Medicaid side. So I think that, and there, my colleague Ann Beal led a study and produced a report, Closing the Divide, that looked at medical home for low-income and minority patients and was able to show that having a medical home helped to promote greater equity. She was also found in her analysis that based on, and this was just indicators of medical home, it wasn't nearly as comprehensive as what Diane was able to do from her survey, but based on these indicators, that respondents were in community health centers were less likely to have a medical home, to report having a medical home, than those in private physician offices. However, when she did a follow-up analysis that looked among those in a community health center, those who had a personal physician, they were much more likely to have a medical home. So I think, again, I think that they're ideally situated. I actually think the community health centers can help lead this effort and become models of excellence, not just for the safety net, but for all providers. But I think currently they're not necessarily fulfilling that promise, although I think they have the capacity to do so. The Commonwealth Fund hopes to help community centers, community health centers, and primary care clinics serving low incomes achieve that vision with a new demonstration that we're launching to work with 50 safety net clinics in 4 regions of the country.
Okay. Yes, go ahead.
Jason Spangler from Partnership for Prevention. It appears, in going to a lot of these medical home discussions, that the focus is on chronic care disease management. To many people, that's mainly what the medical home is about. And Dr. Davis talked a little bit about prevention and preventive services, but I'm just wondering if you think prevention is getting lost or the role of prevention in the medical home and preventive services could be expanded, especially when you talk about high value. I mean, most preventive services are high value services. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on prevention and preventive services in the medical home.
I think prevention is as much a part of primary care as chronic illness. Doing chronic care and treating chronic illness. I think it does sometimes get a little bit lost in the discussion. But if you've got an organization that's truly functioning as a patient-centered medical home and putting the patient at the center and helping them to identify their own priorities and to come in maybe when they didn't know they needed to come in, whether it be for chronic care follow-up because you need to see the ophthalmologist once a year because you have diabetes, or because you need to do a urine sample once a year because you have diabetes, or because we need to check your medications on a routine basis with your asthma or whatever it is, those same kinds of systems that you put in place and the same sort of outreach and counseling and training and the way that the office is organized benefits then, as long as the payment isn't specifically only targeted to a given disease, it should also benefit. You should be able to identify those women in your practice who are of the age when they need routine mammogram screening, or those patients who need colon cancer screening. You should be able to find them and identify them and provide them with that information that they would want, or, like I said, tobacco. And we did measure that in ours, and it was included there. So it was chronic disease and prevention.
If I could just add to that, we have built many of the things that Diane mentioned. We've tried to build into our approach at the primary care level, and using our information technology platform, we'll find those folks who need things, send them reminders. We have over 100,000 patients now on a web portal to our electronic record where they can check to see what they need or what kinds of things that will be coming up. They can make their own appointments. We can, our case managers, if they have a chronic disease, can send them a message. If they don't have a chronic disease, we can still send them a message and say, please come get your mammogram or your flu shot or whatever. So there's a lot you can do with electronics. We've also created bundles of care. So, for example, with diabetes or with coronary artery disease, and you can do this with other things, we now have a preventive bundle that we brought up this year using electronic medical record where we use diabetes because it's easier. There are nine diabetic things that we feel that best practice would say that you should make sure that get done. And we track those using our reminder systems, et cetera, but we track them and we give ourselves credit only if we get 100% of all of them for a given patient. So if you look at slide 14 in the handout, our diabetes bundle score is 9% went to 11%, but that's most of the individual metrics are in the 80s or 90s. Very tough to get everyone every time, but that's how we measure it. And you can do that with the IT systems and registries and things that folks have. Much harder to do in a paper world, but I think the approach is very similar, whether it's chronic or preventive.
What I would say in specific response to your question, though, is really do we feel that the demonstrations and a lot of the discussion is really about chronic care? And I think that the chronic patient population tends to dominate sometimes in the public fora for two reasons. One, because they're the high-cost patients. Two, because the way CMS and has designed the Medicare medical home demonstration, and that the screening criteria means that you have to have one or more chronic conditions to participate. But the truth is just exactly reiterating what the others have said, is that the prevention piece is as important as all the other pieces. We think that when we look at the cost savings, we're going to see changes in utilization patterns, which means probably fewer hospital admissions and readmissions, and that'll probably be on those with chronic care. But really, again, it is about both pieces. And if you look at a broader range of demonstrations, particularly those in Medicaid, state Medicaid programs or commercial payers, you're seeing that they're not selecting exclusively those patients with chronic conditions.
Could I jump in also? I just want to follow up on, it was actually Congress who said that the Medicare, should focus on patients with chronic conditions. CMS actually took a very liberal interpretation of what that meant and was able to find about 85% of Medicare beneficiaries would qualify. And I would just associate myself with all of the remarks that everybody needs patient-centeredness, and I remembered the fourth element of primary care, which is basic coordination of care. Everybody will benefit from 24/7 access, basic continuity with a specific clinician, basic coordination of care with other physicians and other providers, and ideally comprehensive care from the same place. On top of that, there's, I think, the way to rationalize this, there's an opportunity then to have special activities related to chronic care patients with multidisciplinary teams and relying on other professionals to, as well as electronic health records, to provide specific supports for that high cost and difficult, challenging population.
Yes, in the back.
Yes, I'm Mary Tierney. I'm with the American Institutes for Research. And I'm a pediatrician, so I had to get up and say, again, thank you to the first speaker who recognized that the American Academy of Pediatrics has been working on this for 35 years. And I'm glad that this concept is finally coming into the adult population. It's not particularly a new concept. One of the things that we have found, and that's a question for anybody on the panel, is to what extent have you been incorporating care management, case management in this? How are you getting it paid for? We in pediatrics have been totally relying a lot on case management, and luckily Medicaid, up until recently when it's gotten fuzzy, has been able to pay for these services. So anybody who can answer that, I'd be interested.
Have case management as a very integral part of our team-based approach. And in fact, while you could perhaps finance how to get that case management into a practice, one of our learnings has been that if we get those case managers into the practice itself, they are much more effective than when we had them even in our own integrated system in the health plan. And so what we've done is we've basically funded them and said, go ahead, put a case manager in. We have shared some case managers. If there's a small satellite practice next to a larger one, we have, I think it's critical in terms of a lot of this coordination. It's also critical in the sense that the folks that were in that slide that represent 85% need to have someone that they can rely on, that they trust, that they know they can get. Example, infrastructure change, we put direct lines into the case managers and cell phones and educated the patients and their families that those were the folks that you would call. You wouldn't call the regular number. I think the danger to it, though, is that case management just by itself is not what we want to do here and will overwhelm that nurse or whoever's doing it fairly quickly. But if they're an integral part of team and they do those things, as Diane said, that they're good at, doc now freed up to do something else, the electronic record frees other people up to do other things, then it really starts to work. But they are absolutely critical in terms of coordinating this.
If I could just jump in, I mean, clearly that question invited a whole discussion of how we're paying for this and should we be paying, you know, how to pay. I mean, clearly a lot of it is not happening today because there's no payment outside of face-to-face visits. There's no payment to a practice for case management. So one of the prevailing payment options is to continue paying for face-to-face visits, but then provide a monthly per person per month payment to support a whole range of medical home activities that would include case management. And then that invites a discussion of should we make that payment regardless of whether the practice is successful in these activities, or should we assess the performance of the practice at holding down costs, and if so, then provide the payment. I mean, the payment options are a whole nother discussion, but clearly a lot of these activities are not happening today because in our fee-for-service system based around CPT coding and payers being reasonably nervous that a whole bunch of medical home services, it's hard to sort of know what you're paying for. These are softer services in a sense. They've been reluctant, and that's why we want to do extensive pilot testing to build the business case for if you do pay for case management and these other activities, you get a return on investment. That return on investment hasn't been proved, but it's certainly plausible. And Geisinger's sort of leading with some of this work.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that in the demonstrations, the Commonwealth Fund is supporting a number of evaluations of these demonstrations to determine whether or not it really does slow the rate of healthcare cost growth. And we are seeing even within these evaluations a range of payment options from the per member per month on top of the fee for service to a per member per month fee for service with a pay for performance. It's called the hybrid payment model that's being promoted by the American College of Physicians and American College of Family Physicians, to more of a pay-for-performance, like a very generous pay-for-performance type model that's being tested in the Mid-Hudson Valley region in New York, to a kind of a global capitated risk-adjusted payment for primary care that's also going to be tested in a number in 9 practices in Massachusetts and Albany, New York. So we are seeing a variety of payment models, and hopefully from these evaluations we'll learn some of the advantages and disadvantages of the various approaches being tested so far.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Jonathan Peck from Institute for Alternative Futures. If I may take you back to the community health clinics question, I did get to work with community health clinics in Hawaii this summer, and they reinforce what you've said, Melinda, that in effect they don't have all the components of a medical home, but they have evolved towards many of them, including much better care coordination, and they don't have the electronic medical records, for example. But they are using navigators, including volunteers from the community, And what was striking to me is that while these are set up for the medically indigent, they're now attracting in pay patients who are insured but who have heard that this is the best care you can get.
Good. Thank you.
I think that that's true, that there are certainly places, and I've certainly visited places, where the care that was happening in the community health center in terms of the organization and the efficiency, the patient-centeredness, the whole person care, the on-site, you know, social worker, the on-site, other allied health professionals who could assist immediately, the on-site nutrition. There are some incentives built into that system in some places in this country. There are some supplemental payments, some collaboratives that you can participate in. So I think it's a little bit of a myth that for some reason private practice is just simply better than community health center practice. I just think that's not true. I think there are places where there's visionary leadership in a community health center where they're able to mobilize with very scarce resources and lead in a way that's very innovative and deliver care that's much more patient-centered. And actually, we've seen some studies that have shown some very excellent outcomes among even the chronically ill and the very sick. So I think we have to keep – there are some models out there that we could probably learn a lot from.
And if any of you have had exposure to the Denver health system, a lot of what Diane was just describing came to mind as I was remembering the field visit we did a few months ago to the Denver health system, where the community health centers are completely electronically wired and are starting to attract paying patients precisely because they're delivering the kind of care that you want to see. Yes, go right ahead.
Thank you. I'm Eva Powell with the National Partnership for Women and Families, and I'm leading a consumer-oriented health information technology project. So I remember back early when we first started with the session that it was mentioned something about patients and consumers trusting this or buying into it, but we've not talked a whole lot more about that. I'm curious from Dr. Davis, what has been Geisinger's experience in terms of how this model has really helped improve shared decision-making, because implicit in patient-centered care is the shared decision-making, and all of this, of course, is necessary for that, but if the patient's not part of that, it's not really patient-centered.
Well, I think if the rest of this is early, this part is really early, and we recognize that we need to work on that piece. We've begun to work on it primarily by sort of doing what we do and hoping that, like Hawaii, people say, wow, this is good. You know, you should go there, as opposed to, let's say, marketing it or something like that. We have done several different kinds of things. We try to make folks aware of what's different and then try to understand whether they actually see it as different, because many of our patients are fairly stable. They've been in these sites, and the question is, do you notice anything different? Is this better? The second thing we do is we try to use some of our customer service folks throughout our system to do proactive outreach, and we're working on making those folks more virtual. Like many traditional call centers, ours have been centralized, but we want to make those virtual. We think we can with technology, and so we've got one of the pilots has an outreach program where we basically touch base with the patients fairly frequently, get to know them. Hopefully they'll get to know those folks on the team, and we'll be able to say, you know, anything we can do for you, anything going on, that kind of thing. It's slow. We've got some really early anecdotal evidence that people recognize it, that it's been recognized in the community, but we don't have data yet. We are planning on measuring that, though.
Yes, go right ahead.
Yes, my name is Dr. Beverly Coleman Miller, and I'm an internal medicine physician and a public health advocate. And one of my questions is, with all of the virtual dimensions to this, is there anything being done specifically to help with mental health in this, the chronic mental health disease patients?
Very good question.
Okay.
I mean, I can just say that from our data, I'm actually looking at so we had focused on these four chronic conditions in our initial survey, and they were congestive heart failure, asthma, diabetes, and depression. And I'm actually in the process of analyzing the data and looking specifically at depression, because we do know that that some of these same issues around, I mean, this is now more the chronic care model, but some of these components of the chronic care model that have been touted for and really are beginning to gain some traction for diabetes and for asthma, and I think there's a cost-saving argument there or a value-based argument there, are certainly also being studied, and there's data showing that these things also work for mental health and depression. And there's a much bigger divide between what we know should be happening for patients with depression and what is actually happening in depression. So that across the board, no matter what we asked about, we found that that organizations that were doing head care management on some level for these other diseases, the last disease to look at or the last chronic condition that they would then focus on would be depression. And so those numbers were the lowest across the board. So we're sort of in the process of looking at that and trying to explain it. But certainly I think it doesn't help that we've segmented mental health as a separate, I mean, as a family doctor, it's hard, you know, we keep finding, well, these are the chronically ill, and these are the ones who need preventive care, and these are the ones who need mental health. And, you know, when you're sitting in the doctor's office, that's not how they come in. You know, it's all part of the same patients.
I was just going to add, say, I think it is a part of the vision and yet not yet realized in any way that we be content or pleased with. One area that I know that Diane and I are actually working on together, where they're really trying to address this in the safety net and the mental and the physical together, is in New Orleans, in a number of the small primary care safety net clinics in that area, really trying to integrate it and tracking it just as closely as they tracking the mental health and chronic mental health issues just as closely as they're tracking the other chronic disease areas.
And let me just, my comment would be that we're in talking with nurses from the more traditional call center-based disease management dealing with sort of single diseases, heart failure, COPD, what I heard was that depression, concurrent depression, seems to be common, and that they don't make a lot of progress on the disease which ostensibly they're treating unless they can work with the primary care practice to work on depression also. And so just the logic, as Dr. Davis has said, of trying to lodge this disease or care management in the practice rather than through some distant call center, I mean, the logic is there. We're just going to have to see how it plays out. The point I tried to make earlier about unfettered expectations is that we got to be careful about going from where we are today to putting so many expectations on the medical home that it doesn't have a chance to grow. I mean, but in 10 years or whenever this sort of hits its stride, there is no question that one of the objectives is that mental health problems that are amenable to detection and treatment or referral by the medical home should be much better handled than it is today.
Okay, yes, go right ahead.
Yeah, I'm Dr. Roberta Lilly. I'm from the Health Policy Department at George Washington. I'm interested in trying to figure out how to measure performance on a patient-centered medical home. And I realized we could look at each practice and determine whether or not there were policies and procedures in place that cover the seven domains that are important to the patient-centered medical home. But wouldn't it be easier to look at the failures? In other words, if we took an aggregate measure of all, if our denominator is all the patients, for instance, with chronic diseases, and then we aggregated the number of those patients that visited an emergency department, were admitted to the hospital, or died, wouldn't that give us some degree of reliability in determining success or failure or efficacy in the entire, the aggregate purpose of the medical home? In other words, to improve patient care overall. Do any of you have a comment on that?
Huh?
Yeah, I'm willing to try. That's why some people have recommended that whatever additional payments are made for medical home activities is contingent upon a performance analysis, including things like hospital rates, ER visits. It might even be a per person per month rather than per member, because these aren't technically members. They haven't signed up. But that's my own hang-up. But basically, to do a cost analysis. The problem, because this isn't new, this 20 years ago, the U.S. healthcare model of paying primary care physicians was essentially you get your monthly payment, and then we're going to analyze your risk pool and see how you're doing on managing downstream costs, and we'll either give you your withhold back or we might even give you a bonus. I mean, in a sense, pay for performance, it has a new name, but it's not new. What was a problem with that, and what still is a challenge, is risk adjustment. Being able to account for the fact that the doctor who may have a high hospitalization rate is specifically gets a lot of referrals for very difficult patients to manage. I think we've made great progress in being able to do risk adjustment at the individual clinician level, but that is a challenge. But ultimately, again, I think that's ultimately what we, instead of being heavily sort of process-oriented, which do you have the following systems in place, we ultimately do want to be outcomes-oriented. And let me, while I have the microphone, identify one of the real challenges here, it seems to me, in measuring performance, is that we really want to be able to measure patients' experience. Is this practice patient-centered? And I don't think you can get that by asking the practice whether they're patient-centered. I think you really do somehow have to figure out, I mean, there's now measurement sets out there, and Melinda knows this more than I do, but we should have to figure out how to get, without spending lots of money on surveys and things, getting feedback from patients and being able to put that as a major sort of performance measure is the patient-centeredness. I don't want to just be measuring performance on HEDIS measures, on quality, and sort of ER and hospitalizations.
Right, and actually that speaks to one of the questions here, which I feel like also follows up on your question. I mean, I think part of the reason that the measures are done currently by at the physician or the practice level is because the underlying philosophies of the concept is that it's voluntary. And so that if a practice meets some objective criteria, it's eligible for enhanced payment. So, I mean, that's part of why we have this, and that's, you know, that's in many ways the philosophy of the National Committee for Quality Assurance's physician recognition programs. Whether or not they should be physician recognition or practice recognition is another story. I probably favor practice recognition, which also will help us get around some of these workforce issues around, like, which providers qualify. We just focus on the functions of a practice. But I think that's why you see it kind of done at this practice-by-practice level. What someone submitted a card here says, most of the research and position statements on the medical home by Commonwealth, AAFP, et cetera, emphasize a personal relationship with the primary care physician, enhanced access, and care coordination. However, the actual NCQA scoring guidelines seem to emphasize infrastructure, such as EMRs and registries, and having a personal doctor, open access care, teams, distribution. You know, do you think the NCQA scoring guidelines accurately capture the medical home? And so I guess I just want to follow up in trying to answer your question globally around measurement. I completely agree with Bob that you don't know if a practice is patient-centered unless you ask the patient. It is just fundamental. Where we are today on the measures is that we have some measures to look at the systems and infrastructure within a practice to monitor those systems that we think are associated with patient-centered care. But those are really just supposed to be, in some ways, just eligibility criteria. They don't tell us about the performance of that practice. If we were going to look at the performance of a medical home, we'd have to look at clinical quality and patient experience. And that's really where, you know, so really we need to be looking at three kinds of data. There is a lot of research going on right now that we are working with or we're supporting NCQA to look at whether or not we can, whether or not they can consider, not they can consider, I mean, I don't want to put it on them, but whether or not patient experience scores, the results of those surveys can be used for eligibility criteria, because ultimately that's where we would like to go. There are a lot of problems with that in terms of standardization of tools, even though we have the CAP, standardization of sampling, practices aren't necessarily, you know, they're not used to collecting at the practice level and in office, you know, surveys from patients, at least that's what I'm told. So there are a lot of different issues in terms of also how you would do this. And then Bob says to me that maybe our approach is we're trying to be too sophisticated. He might be right. So right now we're trying to support a lot of different research to figure out how can we how can we incorporate the patient experience both for the eligibility and as part of the payment. What I will say is on all of these evaluations that we're supporting and considering, not only are they looking at changes in utilization, costs, and efficiency, not only are they also looking at clinical quality, they are all looking at patient experience between the patients in the medical home and those that are not, the comparison groups. And to also see these changes in the infrastructure, are they associated with better experience? And if not, then there's something else that we're missing in this current model and the current technical assistance to help practices transform.
Thank you.
Could I add one just final add on to that one? It's a very interesting question. The only way we're ultimately, I assume, going to get the kinds of data that you were recommending, hospitalization rates and ER rates, is actually going into the payer's database and getting it. In one of the site visits we did, the physician was able to show us her patient experience survey that the payer went to the patients and asked them to rate their physicians on some basic questions, the kinds of questions that Commonwealth uses in their international comparison. After hours, do you have a place to call and where you're confident that you'll get a response? Some really basic things, and she was able to just show me that. So I actually think there's a role here for the payers to complement the evaluation at the practice level on these issues of outcomes.
We have just over 5 minutes left to go. We have about, 418 green cards up here. We're not going to get to all of your questions. I apologize for that. While we get to a couple of them, I would ask you to pull out the blue evaluation form and start filling it out so that we can make use of your patient satisfaction surveys, if you will. I wanted to synthesize a couple of comments and a couple of questions, and it has to do with the size of the practices that we're talking about here. Dr. Rittenhouse's research centered on relatively large practices, 20 or more. The questioner asks, how will the model affect solo and small practices? Won't it encourage more integration and merging of practices in order to compete and survive? And I have to say that one of the aspects of this that was most striking to me was just finding out what the distribution of practice size was in the United States for physicians. And I wonder if you could both try to answer the question and provide all of us with a little factual background about the onesies and twosies versus the 20s in this country. Bob?
I think this is one of the toughest issues and what needs attention, because on the one hand, you can argue that all of the good things that Geisinger is doing that I don't think can be done in a solo practice are such that we want to move all solo practices into being part of larger organizations. What I've suggested in some of my work is that Geisinger should, and organizations like Geisinger should, be especially working to capture those decentralized primary care practices. I think there's actually, on the sort of responsiveness side of the patient-centered medical home, I think small practices have a lot to offer. As I've observed, for 35 years that I've been doing this business, Ed and I are old enough to have been doing it about the same amount, I have been hearing about Kaiser Permanente, Intermountain Healthcare, Geisinger, and Mayo, occasionally Group Health of Puget Sound. It's the same organizations. We haven't sort of, this model hasn't grown broadly. In work I've done with the Center for Studying Health System Change, we've documented there's single specialty mergers, not mergers into integrated multi-specialty group practice. So there, I think our payment system has been a barrier to this and other public policy, but there may be something about decentralized independent practices that clearly has the docs like it, although the recent graduates want to be part of larger organizations. Patients seem to like it. We need, a larger evidence base before we want to make a public policy decision to really try to move all those little practices into larger organizations. And so where I come out is that we need to be looking at sort of virtual integration models. And I would point to North Carolina Medicaid, which provided a patient-centered medical home payment to their primary care docs, essentially, as I understand it, and I went down and interviewed some people, essentially to do good primary care, to treat their Medicaid patients like they treat their private patients, meaning don't send them to the emergency room after hours, take the phone call, work with them as they are any other patient, and that produced some cost savings, just simply the 24/7 access to their regular source of care. And then what North Carolina did is they embedded in the community some of the chronic care model activities, and in particular care management nurses, not located at a call center a few states off, but in the local hospital or in the local health department, with that nurse developing personal relationships with the practices, with the patients, able to go to the hospital. So until we're ready to simply try to have a public policy that says we don't want those little practices, I don't think we're there yet, I think we want to look at models that have a one kind of payment model for the Geisingers, which I wouldn't call a medical home. I would call it an accountable care system. They're doing things in subspecialty care and cabbage warranties and a whole bunch of things that go well beyond just medical homes. We want one kind of model for large organizations like that, and then we want to try to move small practices in the right direction, but my view is you want to get them at least to be good primary care practices, many of whom have stopped being that. There are practices in this country now who don't answer their phones after 5 o'clock. We want them to do primary care and try to complement them, whether they can get larger and bring those elements into the practice or whether they should be part of a community network. I think that's the kind of work that needs to be done to try to sort out what works best. And my hunch is it'll work differently in different places.
Diane, you want
to? I just wanted to comment that I think there are different issues, and I think they're very important to address both. I agree with what Bob was saying. I think that the larger groups that are already doing it, the very, very large groups who are all, and the Geisingers and the Mayas and the Kaiser Permanentes, it's, you know, they're not taking over the country. They're not seeing 100% of the patients. They're not doing all, I mean, you would think that might be happening, but it's not. So there's something about the healthcare system that says we cannot only look at those few organizations. We can look to them, but they are not going to be necessarily, unless things change dramatically going forward, the solution to the entire healthcare system problem. And so we need to also look at other places in the healthcare system. And while the large groups have been successful, some of these large groups have been very successful in transforming the way that medicine is practiced, they're still suffering from the primary care crisis in that they're not able to recruit the physicians that are trained to do the kinds of things that they want them to do, and they're having to kind of, you know, retrain them or bring them in. I think in the small settings, You've got doctors who are out there practicing the kind of medicine they always wanted to practice, but they're not successful at transforming their practices. They weren't taught to do that in med school. They're not paid to do that. So we're asking them to, you know, you were trained and are paid to do this, but we're actually now asking you to do this. And that's a very different kind of issue. And I think unless we sort of recognize that these are different animals and that we have different kinds of solutions for different sorts of organizations, we're going to be, we're going to stay in this mess. And I think I keep sort of falling back on that. Is it easier to transform medical practice if you have 500 doctors? Or is it easier to transform medical practice if you have two doctors? And so for the people who say, oh, only the large groups can do it, you know, I think we're just maybe not quite framing the issues, and there needs to be some maturity in kind of what our ideas are, what we're actually asking people to do.
If I could just add to that, I agree with both Diane and Bob, but just again, on the ground, some early personal experience with it. One of the things that we've kind of said to ourselves is we're not going to make our EHR proprietary, although there are a lot of rules about how we can share it and not share it. Some of those in the way of progress, and some of them, you know, we can get fixed. But we're also going to try to work with some of the small two-man primary care sites that contract with Geisinger Health Plan as part of integrated health system. And there was, you know, we don't have the answers to this, but we really thought we should try it and see if we could learn what were the barriers and what kinds of things might work. What's interesting, and I don't think shocking to anybody, is when you start doing something and the word gets out, they're in the same town, they go, hey, can we get in on that? And so we said, let's try it. And they don't have all the things that you've mentioned. They have to be, as a practice, willing to collaborate and, you know, to some degree trusting that you're not trying to disadvantage them in some way. But we found that we could provide a lot of the information and the care manager, the case manager, and those things that they might need to get going and get started. And while it's not a model for everybody, it did work. We were able to take one small two-man practice and work with them and use our resources to allow them to practice in that way and to begin to convert. And I think you're right. The thing, even in the big group practice, the folks that are at our place, including me, were never trained to do this. And so I think you have to somehow allow the time for all of us to relearn it and then to, you know, think outside the box and design it and sort of, you know, be able to try something and see if it works and then go on. Now, you know, there are restrictions to that. They're called time, money, and all those kinds of things. But the experience we had with that one small two-man practice is it probably is doable. It's hard. They have to want to. But I think Diane's right. I think there are a lot of ways to skin this cat, and we just have to keep trying.
Terrific. Melinda, any final words? Two down, several hundred thousand to go, right? I don't think this is going to be the last time we talk about medical homes with you on this in this room. And I want to, while I finish my remarks and you finish filling out the blue evaluation forms, just say that this has been one of the more lively discussions that we have had on a topic that is going to recur not only 10 years from now, but in the context of health reform discussions over the course of the next year, I have no doubt. I want to thank the Cracker Jack Alliance staff who made everything run as smoothly as it did. I want to thank Commonwealth and particularly Melinda and her colleagues who have expressed not only a strong interest in this, but put their money where their mouth is in backing research and getting involved in it. And I want to ask you to join me in thanking the panel for an incredibly good discussion of a very complicated topic. Be continued.